President Trump's 28-point peace plan for Ukraine sparked a wave of pushback from Europe and nowhere more sharply than here in Berlin. But how successful will Chancellor Merz be in his efforts to keep the Europeans at the table when it comes to Ukraine? And what do the last few days mean for future US-German relations? I look forward to hearing the thoughts of someone who can truly say that transatlantic relations is his thing. Dominik Tolkstov, you were in DC for 6 years. You went there when President Trump first took power in 2016. And you've also worked at the Heart of Europe in Brussels. And now you're with the German Council on Foreign Relations here in Berlin. So welcome to Berlin Briefing, Dominik. And hi, Michaela. Michaela Küfner, you were traveling with the German Chancellor Friedrich Merz. You were at the G20 summit in Africa when that 28-point peace plan actually dropped. And you can tell us all about what happened behind the scenes, how the Europeans, how the Germans tried to form a strategy, how to come up with a response. So very much looking forward to that. You got a chance also to interview the German Chancellor just a couple of hours, really, in the middle of all those negotiations that were happening. And we are posting that interview here down below again, so you can watch Michaela's one-on-one with Friedrich Merz from last Sunday if you want. And first up, I would like to say happy Thanksgiving to everyone who's celebrating. And Dominik, maybe a quick warm-up question or two. Do you celebrate Thanksgiving, given that you have, you know, probably also American friends and your family rooted in American culture?
Yeah, of course. Like when we lived in the United States, we would always celebrate Thanksgiving with family. Nowadays, of course, here on Thursday, it's a work day, but we will have a big Thanksgiving celebration indeed on Saturday with friends who are also Americans or half German, half American. And I look forward to that.
What is your initial thought, if you had to sum it up? Was it a good week or a bad week for US-German relations?
Well, I think the second part of the week was a better week, I would say. I mean, after the 28-point plan was released or at least became public, I think that was kind of like the nightmare scenario for the Europeans. And then the Geneva talks basically ended with a compromise, it sounds like, also where the European positions have been taken into account and, of course, the Ukrainian positions. So I would say it's a mixed bag.
So, Michaela, you were traveling with Friedrich Merz. You went to the G20 summit when that peace plan, those 28 points, had dropped. So can you tell us, just give us a bit of details, what was their reaction?
Well, that was like a comet hitting the Europeans, that 28-point plan, because it threw into doubt everything they believed Donald Trump would still stand for and would not touch. Just to illustrate, there was one passage in there that the US would be essentially a go-between between NATO and Russia.
To mediate between NATO and Russia.
Exactly. So it verbally, removing the United States from NATO, frankly, NATO falls together like a souffle without American engagement. So that was a complete shock to the Europeans. Friedrich Merz tried for almost 24 hours to get Donald Trump on the phone. He finally did, just before stepping on that plane to the G20. And he did manage to turn him around to a certain degree on that Witkoff draft of the 28 points, and got an assurance that there would be negotiations, which then took place on Sunday. That was a very crucial moment. It was, in a sense, a success for Friedrich Merz because he's the one who actually got him on the phone. Keir Starmer also did, but he's not European Union, so the UK Prime Minister very much in the game, very much in security terms, also a strong voice for the Europeans. But the shock was very deep. It really went to the core of what the Europeans thought Donald Trump wouldn't touch. And it sparked a realization that everything is up for negotiation, everything is subject to a deal, and that the Europeans might, much faster than many are already suspecting, be standing alone without the United States.
And that is the analysis that you took away, right? Can you maybe help our listeners understand how that works when you're traveling as part of the German delegation and you are, you know, trying to get information from them? How do they keep us informed? What did they specifically last weekend? How did that work? How did you get a feeling for what was going to happen, what the German position was? Did you see them running around? Did you try and pull them aside? Did you speak to the foreign policy advisors?
Global business isn't just charts and suits.
It's a messy, unpredictable soap opera set on a global stage.
Hi, I'm Daniel.
And I'm Cassandra.
If you think the economy is boring, you've been watching the wrong show.
In our weekly podcast, The Dip, we'll help you connect the dots.
That's DW's The Dip, available wherever you get your podcasts.
Well, it's always very telling when there's a departure from the usual choreography, which means that we're all on board. And then after a short while, Friedrich Merz comes back, speaks to journalists, takes some questions, and then everybody sits down, writes down their notes. And you know, we're not allowed to quote from most of it usually, but then takes in that information. This time it was so ad hoc and it was so in up in the air that we got briefed by Friedrich Merz's spokesman before getting on the plane that this phone call had taken place.
That is very unusual. Probably, right?
That's very unusual to get snippets of information because things were simply moving so fast. And there were several moments where we were asking, okay, who's going to be at these talks? We didn't know it was going to be Geneva, but we knew there would be talks. Who would attend? Well, we don't know yet. It's all in the flow. It's all up in the air. This is the kind of stuff nobody briefs you on usually because they only start talking to the press once they actually know what's going to happen next. So it was genuinely a situation where the next step was unclear, where a principle had been agreed on with Trump that in itself was a success. But the question, who, what, when, where, just to illustrate, the foreign policy advisor Friedrich Merz did go on that 11-hour flight to Johannesburg only to then decide en route that he would go pretty much straight back after a couple of hours there
back to Europe
to join those negotiations in Geneva. So that he clearly got on the plane in the wrong direction for what his task was going to be, because it wasn't clear what that would be at the point of departure.
And that was also seen as a success by the German government, that the talks were actually being held in Geneva and not in, say, Budapest or somewhere where, you know, even the locations of these peace talks are now, I mean, they've always been political, but this is one of the points that people did remark on here. You know, at least we got them to happen somewhere in a neutral country at the heart of Europe. I want to bring Dominic back in here. Dominic, Michaela also already mentioned the phrasing of, you know, the US sort of mediating between NATO and Russia that was in that plan. There were, of course, a couple of other really big concerns as well when it came to the content of that peace plan and the way it had essentially come to life. Can you talk to us about what the main concerns were? I'm just mentioning, you know, that those allegations that the text had originally been in Russian and translated into English. Then also there were those discussions about the phone call between Donald Trump's aide, Steve Witkoff, whose phone call to a top Kremlin aide, Yuri Ushakov, was leaked.
Yeah, exactly. I think like the whole document was quite of a shock for everyone who was able to see it. And of course, like it was the whole world who could see it because it was leaked. I think there were just a lot of like provisions in that that basically really made a lot of concessions to the Russian side. And I mean, the discussions have been going on in the United States, of course, like how this document came about and who actually drafted it. And then, of course, there was a lot of different rumors going on. Marco Rubio made a lot of statements that were not consistent. And in the end, it is pretty clear that this was some sort of document that was between Witkoff and his Russian counterpart negotiated. And that I think even Trump later on had to admit, yeah, this is just the start of the sort of discussions, and we just wanted to have some document that we can work with. But of course, the first priority for the Europeans at that moment was, let's go into all of these points. They came up with their own proposal that they fed into the process in Geneva, and were obviously successful in feeding in some of them.
And this was also a conscious decision by the Europeans, whose first impetus really was to say, this is totally not acceptable. The question then was, do we make a counter proposal or do we take this document and try and fix it? And the concern was so great that this would lead to rejection by Trump to have like a European owned proposal, which could then be rejected. So I think, you know, in the panic of the moment, and there were instant consultations, particularly between the E3 leading within Europe, so that included Britain, to then say, look, we have to work with, we really can't accept this document, but we have to work with this. We have to try and diffuse the worst parts of it. And this was then seen as pretty much a success, also to get rid of, as we're hearing, provisions on territory, the limitations on troops. Some people here in German parliament have raised the question, look, if there's a provision for the limitation of troops in Ukraine, why not in Russia as well? And it's obviously clear that this is not palatable for Russia. And we've since, of course, now heard back from Vladimir Putin saying that he wants the Donbass region, he wants Crimea. So the question of territorial integrity, of course, is the key one in a war. That is something that the Russian side will continue to push hard. So initially, we had the deadline of the day we're recording this. Donald Trump wanted a signing ceremony. He wanted Volodymyr Zelensky to be there, ideally, potentially, the Russian president. We never really got that far. And to be able to demonstrate to the US public that he's made peace once again.
And this it reached the point where people here in Berlin were talking about, you know, very cynically saying, well, essentially, Donald Trump wants Zelensky as a Thanksgiving turkey, right? And that Thanksgiving deadline, I mean, serious people were making that comment behind the scenes. But that Thanksgiving deadline, as we all know, has now passed and negotiations are continuing. So Friedrich Merz essentially reached a success by keeping the Europeans on board and at the table. He made that point about how important it is to have Europe involved when it comes to the future of European security when he addressed the German parliament this week in a speech that is normally dedicated to domestic politics, because the German parliament is currently voting on the budget for next year. But he made that point, and let's just listen to what he said.
I therefore welcome the continued American commitment to resolving this conflict. And I said exactly that to President Trump in a telephone call last Friday. But at this fateful moment for Ukraine, for Europe, and for our alliance with America, I also want to make it clear that decisions on European matters can only be taken in agreement with Europe. Europe is not a pawn, but a sovereign actor pursuing its own interests and values.
And there's two things I want to point out here. First of all, the way he phrases this, he keeps saying decisions about Europe cannot be taken without Europe. He never says to Donald Trump that it's unacceptable for him to take decisions that are about Europe without Europe. He would not say
mention
that.
Him by name.
Well, he wouldn't criticize. He wouldn't openly criticize. He makes a more general statement out of it. But of course, the key success of the Geneva talks was that Marco Rubio, the US Secretary of State, assured that there would be no decisions about Europe without Europe. But he is one voice in the US administration. And this is something Steve Witkoff, frankly, does not care about. So there is a power struggle between Steve Witkoff, the special advisor on Ukraine, and the US Secretary of State. And that is something that also makes it more difficult for the Europeans to know which end Donald Trump has listened to more closely. So that was a success for the Europeans, but in a very, very disconcerting scenario, and this is a moment of reckoning for the Europeans. The word wake-up call has been completely overused over the past years, but this is the moment where it is apparent that not just in Germany, the top leadership is asking itself, seriously asking itself, whether the price of keeping Trump on board is slowly but surely becoming higher than taking your fate into your own hands and completely becoming independent of the US. This is not something that somebody would say openly, but this really sent shockwaves down the spine of key advisors in European capitals.
Dominic, we also heard the former foreign minister here from the Social Democrats, Sigmar Gabriel, in an initial reaction to this 28-point peace plan, saying that this is something that amounts to a betrayal of everything that has so far marked our transatlantic relations. And people also in the conservative camp, they're saying, people like Rodrich Kiesewetter, Norbert Röttgen, they're saying that essentially the US have handed in the divorce papers to the Europeans and that the Europeans need to realise that, and why haven't they done so far? So can you tell us, how do you perceive these kind of comments? Are they helpful, and will we ever, like Michele just said, it's not very likely that we're going to hear them from the German Chancellor, or is it?
I think overall, yeah, there is, of course, this feeling that we have to become more autonomous. We have to work on our own sovereignty in different areas, be it defense, be it technology. But I would also say that the German government wouldn't be that upfront in this sort of critical remarks. I mean, as you just shown, Friedrich Merz is a little bit more cautious. And overall, the German government has been more cautious when it comes to the Trump administration, has been trying to ease tensions with the Trump administration. So I think that is the sort of the pattern that we've seen in the last month since Donald Trump entered into office, and especially after the sort of shock in Munich with the J.D. Vance speech there. And overall, it was rather to maintain a constructive dialogue with the United States going on, be it at the NATO summit, where the Europeans committed to the 5% target, or be it in the trade negotiations with the Trump administrations that were led, of course, by the European Commission, but where the Europeans were making concessions to the American side. And I think also when it comes to the financing of the military aid to Ukraine, which is nowadays mostly done by the Europeans, buying stockpiles from the United States. I think these are all sort of concessions that the Europeans have made in order to also keep a dialogue with the Trump administration and maintain somehow working good working conditions with the administration.
And something else that was in that initial plan was, of course, those frozen Russian assets. We've gotten, you know, a discussion about them. It was decided under Joe Biden already by the G7 that the frozen Russian assets that are here parked essentially in European banks, that a part of that could be used to give a loan to Ukraine so that it can cover its financial needs. Because if nothing happens, and we know that the US is reducing the amount of support to Ukraine, then Ukraine might be a bankrupt country by next spring. So that is seen as a big lever. And Friedrich Merz mentioned those frozen Russian assets and how to use them for Ukraine when he addressed Parliament. Let's just listen to that as well.
We will not slacken in our support for Ukraine. We will support the Ukrainian people for as long as necessary. And we want to make the frozen Russian assets available for precisely this purpose. Putin must realize that he has no chance of winning this war at the expense of European freedom and peace.
And those frozen Russian assets are, to the large share of it, of those frozen Russian assets, is in Belgium, in a Belgian bank. So there's firm opposition from Belgium to essentially give them to Ukraine. Belgium is fearing repercussions, and they are worried that if one day once peace is there, they will be the ones having essentially to foot the bill by themselves. Michaela, that resistance by Belgium is, of course, essentially a stumbling block for the Europeans to show more resolve in really helping Ukraine, in really showing the US as well that they're being serious, that no, the US Americans can't use those frozen Russian assets, that the Europeans will find a way of using them to help Ukraine, right? Or are there other elements as well?
Well, initially there was more of a technical element, that there were concerns about technical implications for Belgian banks as well. Now the negotiations and talks have moved past that point. It's really about whether European partners will guarantee if there are any legal claims, any kind of consequences, that Belgium is not left alone having to pay some $140 billion, which it frankly just simply cannot do. And the big question now is whether all EU countries or enough EU countries will step up to firmly guarantee and pledge potential billions of euros. And that's the process we're in. But I think it's becoming ever clearer to everybody in the European Union, if they don't decide on unfreezing those assets in favor of Ukraine on the 19th of December at that EU summit, that the Europeans have failed and that they are signaling.
That's when EU leaders will get together and everybody's expecting.
Yeah, at that summit, that's kind of pretty much top of the agenda there. So unless the Europeans release that money, Ukraine assistance is going to dwindle. The Germans are standing pretty firm. They continue significant assistance. They keep buying weapons. The Americans in that initial proposal wanted a huge chunk of these frozen assets in terms of a deal. Also selling weapons, doing business. And that's not acceptable for the Europeans. Friedrich Merz has been pretty firm on that as well. He's not confrontative, but he's very firm on this point. And this is really the test how serious and how strongly the Europeans can stand up to Russia beyond the military aspect, where they're simply just not in a position to be that protective power for Ukraine yet.
And that's, of course, also something that is new, because under Olaf Scholz, those talks were beginning about how to use those frozen Russian assets. But it is extremely technically complicated, and it is now the job of the European Commission to find a way of making it legally okay in a way that even Belgium can say yes, right?
My understanding is that they've progressed from that point. That really is, it's now about enough countries pledging money as a fallback position if there are claims then against Belgium, because Belgium would not be willing to shoulder this by itself.
Yeah. And there could also be opposition resistance from other members of parliament across Europe. So, it's not a done deal. It's extremely difficult. We won't know the answer today. But it is definitely a lever that the Europeans will have to use now, because otherwise the US Americans are going to just say, look, the money is there, and we are going to find a way of using them. We are going to find a way of making you and us actually get hold of that money. And Dominic, I want to get your thoughts on that business deal-making aspect. Here in Germany, we heard voices this week as well, accusing Donald Trump and his family and his political circle of actually only being into that topic of Ukraine because they can get money.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I mean, if you really look into this 28-point proposal, the language there, that is really kind of telling you a lot about this approach, as you just mentioned. Is it about U.S. profits? I mean, this provision here, it says the assets should be used in U.S.-led efforts to rebuild and invest in Ukraine, and the U.S. will receive 50% of the profits on that. So it's really, I think the Europeans were really trying to rework the language here, because obviously this is not U.S. money. There are some frozen assets in the United States, but they are minor in comparison to the once frozen in Europe. And it does show and sort of indicate a direction where the US sees this as a business case in the end. I mean, the whole minerals agreement also that was signed was also an indication in that direction. And I mean, it's unclear if this is really something where, you know, this language was used in order to please Trump, or if this is meant seriously in the end. And of course, it is absolutely unrealistic for the Europeans to say, like, okay, sure, like, take these funds and invest them and have, you know, the US side benefit from that. And we even add another $100 billion to this investment fund. I think that is a key point here. But I mean, one thing that I want to mention is that this discussion has been going on for many years. And I think one of the most important strategic decisions that the Europeans took at the very beginning of the war was to freeze these assets. I mean, where would we be now if that decision would have been taken? And that is one of the few levers that the Europeans still have. And the American side has been pushing for a long time for the Europeans to take action on that. But I mean, also the German side was also pretty critical and for a very long time, together also with some other Europeans, the French. And here you can also see a change of direction within the German government, which is good that there's finally an agreement. We have to use these funds before the war ends, because otherwise we don't have any lever on the Russians. Because before that, it was always mentioned as sort of like a fund for the reconstruction of Ukraine after the war ended, and now we are in a different discussion, and that is already good. Let's hope that they find an agreement on that at the next EU summit.
In fact, the 28 plan was also so shocking because all the traditional relations that the Europeans believed were still stable were called into question. I would go as far as saying that these frozen assets are pretty much the only leverage that the Europeans have if they're faced with the United States, who's serious about no longer being necessarily committed to NATO, and throwing all of that overboard, also against the backdrop of the tariffs, which also throws the whole concept of having free trade overboard. So one cannot overstate the importance of these frozen assets as that one pawn that the Europeans still have in this whole power struggle. And that's also why those talks that Friedrich Merz had with Li Qiang, the Chinese prime minister, were so important, because we know and we've listened to Putin stress once again that he wants that Ukrainian territory, that he's on a historical mission. He's not just the businessman. There might be actually a bit of hope for the Europeans in that he's not going to do a straight business deal with Donald Trump. And he will meet with the Chinese foreign minister next week. So if anything can be achieved with the Chinese to contain this, this shows in real time the Europeans now looking towards China to be a stabilizing factor in this. So this is still, once again, very much in the open, but without those frozen assets, the Europeans really wouldn't have much of a security break in there.
How close did we come to yet another really damaging low in US-German relations this week, Michaela?
I'd say it happened. We saw something break.
What broke?
The feeling that somehow it's not going to be a complete rift. And I think that option is now very much firmly on the table. It's now clearly more a relationship of dependency on the United States than it is a transatlantic bond. And there are many institutions built on that in Germany, in the US, on that very concept of this transatlantic Western bond. So you saw a crack go through the traditional West.
Well, thank you very much, Dominic and Michaela. And happy Thanksgiving party to you, Dominic, when you're celebrating. And you out there, if you've listened to this podcast while washing the dishes after your big Thanksgiving dinner, for example, then make sure that you wipe your hands and get back to the computer and send us a comment if you've liked this episode or if you've got any remarks on what we've been discussing, what you'd like to discuss with us. Make sure also, while you're at it, that you subscribe to our Berlin Briefing newsletter that comes out once a week. And make sure you tune in next time. Thank you.